All right, folks, welcome to Mike and Scotty Live. I'm here with my erstwhile partner. What's your name again?
I don't even remember half the time. I feel like the last time I found myself, I was hanging in, on the wall in the post office or on the side of a milk carton. Have you seen this person?
Really?
Back when I was, traveling to a lot of conventions and shows, I had T-shirts made up to sell along with everything else, and they said, got they had the logo on one side and the back. They said "Got Scott,"
Right.
the milk play on the milk logo, and I feel like,
You should reissue those shirts, and on the
yeah,
back, you
should.
should just say no.
Yeah. So, this is all on me, folks. And, I, by way of explanation and apology, we did not produce a podcast last month because my schedule just didn't allow for it. And I know many of you are probably sitting there saying, well, how is it possible you can't carve out an hour a month? And I would probably agree with you,
Well, you put
except
it that
this,
way.
well, yeah. Except to say that, it's just becoming, something that, like I'll use last month as a perfect example. There were no hours anywhere. As many of you know, back in January, I had the privilege of moving in with my fiance and her wonderful three kids, and really transforming back to life of helping to bring up kids and all the responsibilities that go along with kids that range from 17 to 12 years old, as well as my own two kids. So
You got a life.
So I've got a life, and for what it's worth, I'm enjoying it immensely, but it does take time. So my responsibilities are evolving and changing, and as much as I'm enjoying it, I certainly felt bad that we couldn't get the show out last month, and even this month we're running slightly behind, but be that as it may, here we are, and happy to be here. So, Mike, thank you for your patience.
Well, fortunately, Craig Biesgeier stepped in and helped out one time there, and Dave Owens lent his able talents to the podcast related to the meat. Although he sent me a funny email the other day. I guess he hadn't gotten around. I guess he's fairly busy too, so don't feel like you're the only guy. And
Yeah, no, I am.
And this was over a month after we recorded it. He was just getting around to listening to it, and his only response was, "Oh my God, all you can hear is me breathing."
It's funny because I think that most people don't like the way they sound, and I would count myself amongst them.
Oh, me too. I don't think anybody likes the way they sound.
I think that the old joke was, I had a face made for radio and a voice made for newspaper. So be that as it may, I would subscribe to the fact that it's substance over, beauty in this case. And hopefully you and I are providing a little bit of entertainment, a little bit of education, a little bit of insight, and people who are crazy enough to listen to us enjoy what they're listening to and keep coming back.
Well, let's get to some substance then, damn it.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the New England Prototype Modelers meet, which takes off the first weekend and first Friday and Saturday of June. And I'm pulling up the calendar as we speak just so I can get those exact dates if you don't have them off the top of your head, but I do. It's the 1st and 2nd of June.
Actually, it's also the 31st.
Oh, I'm sorry, the 31st and the 1st. I was looking at Saturday and Sunday.
Yep.
So, do we know what number meet this is?
Well, we did when Dave and I talked about it on the last podcast, but that seems like eons ago. I think it's like 18 or something like that.
Man.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I think
I suspect we may not be as young as we were when we started doing all of this.
Well, I remember really, and I'm pretty, well, I'm not pretty sure. I'm absolutely sure that the first time I ever presented the Building Craftsman Structure Kit clinic was at that meet. And that had to be, maybe the second or third year they had it. And I remember, kind of the looks on these prototype modelers' faces as I was discussing, how to put together a fine scale miniature kit, and just getting, some fairly dirty looks. And it didn't dawn on me until probably, a year later that, oh, a lot of these guys wouldn't build a fine scale miniature kit if their life depended on it because it's not what they how they model.
They'd
And I
be
remember.
scratch building some prototype model.
Right, and I retailored the clinic so that it was more generically based on
Technique.
modeling techniques that were useful across the board rather than focusing on a specific type of structure or manufactured structure.
Right. When you were in that business, you would be attending a lot of different kinds of meets, not just prototype modeler meets.
Oh, I'd go to the opening of a door. You had to. And what I learned early on in the business of this hobby is that if you have any chance at all of being successful, one of two things has to happen. You either need to find an incredibly unique niche, well, one of three things. You have to be absolutely better than everybody else. Or you have to hustle your brains out. And I wasn't better than everybody else. And I didn't really, maybe to a degree, I had a niche because no one was really doing instructional DVDs to the degree that I was. But I was out there. I had to get in the car and drive long distances or get on a plane and fly across the country and I felt like the more my face was out there, the more people would remember me, and the more conversations I could have, the more they'd remember me. And Dave Owens was really kind of a catalyst for me. He was very supportive of what I was doing, and I always appreciated everything he did to kind of help me to get to that point. So,
We think about how long now this phase that you were talking about in this process. Think of everything that has changed just during that period of time, right? Think about, for example, the rise of YouTube. And it seems like anytime you need to figure out how to do anything now, you just go on YouTube and it's there. I mean, I use it for that purpose at times.
Well, I go on YouTube and I see some of my DVDs on there.
Really? People have uploaded your DVD. Oh, man.
And not supposed to. One of the DVDs I did in conjunction with Scenic Express.
Right.
And
It's their
so,
content.
what's that?
It's their content.
Well, it actually isn't. I hold the copyright on it. They underwrote the production, and their investment was returned to them. So at that point it becomes, what do you want to do about it? And for me, the process of selling DVDs has kind of dwindled down. I'm no longer traveling and doing shows, so I'm less concerned about it. But I do like the idea of continuing to maintain the legacy. I worked hard, as to produce high quality, informative media. And if it was something that I didn't have expertise in, I had no problem in bringing someone in who did, like yourself. Because it was more important, I guess, than me being on it.
But let me
But
ask you this. When's the last time, even from an entertainment standpoint, that you popped in a DVD, right? It's like that whole medium has sort of become a little bit passé. Everything's instant download of everything.
So it's interesting because I agree with you completely. However, I would also add the caveat that I think the hobby, because the demographic is a little older, was a little slower to grasp that and accept it.
Yes.
So for years and years, my the company that I was using towards the end, the owner of the company, who produced probably the last six DVDs for me, was after me to do this as a digital download.
Right.
And from a production cost standpoint, it would have been much easier to do that. But the feedback I was getting at the shows was that people still wanted DVDs. They didn't truly trust the download process. They didn't really want to have to sit at their computer to watch these things. The all of the feedback, whether it was from the podcast or the DVDs, was that people were using them as an adjunct to their actual modeling.
Oh, yeah.
So they'd be sitting at their modeling bench, and across the room was a TV, and they'd be watching you or me or Bob Van Gelder or whomever doing whatever it was they were doing on the DVD, or they'd be listening to the podcast. I'm gonna say iPod, but for years and years that's how they listened to it.
Sure.
So I think it was by today's standards somewhat old-fashioned. But I think that there was maybe a sense of comfort that they knew how to put in a DVD.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm guessing for a lot of these people when the DVD came out, I mean that was probably a little bit of culture shock too.
Yep.
So you
Well,
mean.
speaking of shock, a couple days ago, I get a Facebook IM from a guy, Ivan Stassa, I believe is his name. And he said that obviously we were friends on Facebook, but of course I have a million Facebook friends. Basically, if you're into trains and you send me a friend request, I'll approve it and immediately unfollow you because I can't keep up with everybody's updates. But if you're interested in mine, you're welcome to them. And he sent me a picture. He said he had met me many years ago at Jim Six's meet in Cleveland, of all places. But he's from the Czech Republic. And I think he had seen something I was commenting on about a particular switch motor that is a European product that's not sold yet in this country, but is very popular in Europe and other places in the world. And I had asked him some questions about it. But he sent me a picture of his TV screen, and it's got my face on it, and he's watching the Weathering DVD. And it's just so strange to see yourself on a TV in the Czech Republic being sent to you over the internet via Facebook, and you just look at that and you think, boy, it really is an interconnected world.
It really is, and you're absolutely right. It used to blow my mind that people in Norway had my DVDs.
Right.
Like, really? I've never been to Norway, but
They have televisions there?
my electronic image has. I think we think locally
Right.
instead of globally,
Well, I mean,
and
look at me. I never leave the compound. I mean,
well, there's no reason for you to anymore,
I
so
try not to.
so anyway, I just as a plug, for folks listening, if you have not had an opportunity to go to the New England Prototype Modelers meet, or you haven't been in a few years.
You're missing out.
And now, was there a change in venue this year, Mike?
Yeah, they had a couple of issues, one of which was that the other venue that was used at Enfield, they're doing, I think, some remodeling or something like that this year, so they
Yes.
couldn't accommodate those dates. But moreover, the meet had grown to the point already just because of it being in a larger venue that they were outgrowing that location. So they were really thinking about shopping around for a better venue that was more suitable to the new audience size anyway, and this kind of pushed them to do that. So they have a new hotel, and it's in Farmington, which is one exit down from where I used to get off to go to the old Collinsville meet. And I'm excited about seeing what they're going to do there this year. It seems like those guys just get better at it every year. Doesn't seem possible, but they do. It's just a good crew, and they're really sincere about what they're doing there, and it shows. So I guess it's no surprise it gets better every year, but that's not an easy trick to pull off.
The endurance it takes to do it 1 year, never mind whatever year this is for them.
Well, remember we did I did helped you with the Craftsman Structure Show one
Sure.
year, and after that I said, yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, I mean
It's
it
just a
is.
lot of work.
You've got to have the right group of people who are selfless and availing of themselves and willing to do something that's never going to put a penny in their pocket, but might, it's going to make them tired and grumpy, but at the end of the day, it might make them feel a little better. And there's a, in the case of Dave's show, obviously there's people we know, but there's people that toil in anonymity, to help him put this thing on.
Oh, it is very much a group effort, and
It has to be,
there's
yeah.
so many people involved. It's kind of hard to call out everybody that is involved, but you see them every year. They're like old friends every year.
Yep. Now you were doing a clinic down there this year. Tell us about it.
The clinic, I think, is going to start with the last year's ending slide, and before we got on to do this, I was actually just kind of looking at that because I've obviously got to generate this clinic in the next couple of weeks here, so no time like the present. So I reviewed the last presentation, and frankly, it amazed me because the final slide of that presentation was a foundation here. That's what it was. The ground.
Wow.
The ground had been broken, but as of the time of that meet, that was all I had. I thought, the mind sort of like blurs out all of the intensity, but I thought that by that time there would have been maybe more done, and it makes it even more amazing what got done subsequently to that. So I am going to have that clinic as well as my July Getting Real column in Model Railroad Hobbyist devoted to what has happened since all of that. You were here not that long ago, what, maybe 3, 4 weeks ago?
Yeah, at the most, yeah.
And you got to see, I mean, you walked in and you just kind of looked around and you said, if I'm not mistaken, I think you said, boy, the pictures just don't capture what's really been going on here.
Yeah,
And I'm
yeah.
inclined to agree, it's a big space, and pictures tend to, if you took like you can't get back far enough to take a picture of the entire thing, and if you could, everything would really really be too small. So you kind of have to see it in person. Probably only meaningful to people who have been here before, but I guarantee that if you have been here before and you haven't seen any of the new stuff, and then you come here, you're going to be surprised.
Yeah, no, I without
I
question.
know my wife is every time she comes down. She just looks around and it's like she's just boggled by it all.
Well, and we're segueing right into this layout update, which is great. And I guess the point I'd make, and it's kind of the point that I've tried to continue throughout any of your layout construction projects, is that you work very quickly because you plan everything out and you can envision what something, usually what something is going to look like before you get too deep into the construction. And that's really a bonus to any model railroader, but something that's also very difficult for a lot of people to achieve.
Well, this particular construction phase, because let's face it, I've been building model railroads in my basement for 30 years. Not much of any of that left, but it was a good learning process. And this particular project benefits from the fact that for really a whole year of planning the addition, it forced me to think about what I wanted to do in it, because when you're starting something like that from scratch, within reason, you have the ability to configure it the way you need to do what you want. Most of the time, you're building a layout that fits the space available. In this case, I had some flexibility with creating the space available, but you almost never get to do that with a model railroad. So I put a lot of thought into what I wanted to do out there. And consequently, when I actually started building out there, certainly in terms of the benchwork and the basic layout of everything, it's gone pretty smoothly. It's benefited from the fact that my buddy Dave, who used to come over on Monday nights for train night, he retired from the railroad. So I have Dave on tap. So that helps a lot, because all of the two-man stuff that I might only get to once a week, well, I can kind of have Dave whenever I need him, pretty much. And that has really helped to push things along at a pretty rapid pace. At this point, I would say 98% of the benchwork that's ever going to be built here is now built. And you know how big the space is, so that's a lot of benchwork, and also a lot of the sub roadbed, and a fair amount of the track has been put in. I was just doing some rough calculating before we came on. I have built at this point, with some help, 136 linear feet of benchwork.
That's pretty amazing.
It's a healthy total. I've installed already 30 new turnouts, and just to give you an idea of the scope of the effort, I've built three staging yards, one of which alone is a four-track staging yard, but it's long enough that it has 32 pieces of flex track in it. So, it gives you also an idea of the investment involved, because a decent piece of flex track is, $4 or $5 these days, believe it or not. A decent turnout is in the $30 neighborhood, so you do the math. Fortunately, I had been accumulating stuff over the course of a couple of years for this project, so haven't had to like run to the hobby shop for pretty much of anything. It's more like running to the lumber yard.
Sure. I mean, just being able to hedge your bet on an inflationary dollar is is a nice way to be able to do it
Well,
and
and I was bought on sale, you know what I mean? So, and I looked at it this way. If I'm buying on sale and I may be buying ahead of some price increases, whatever's left over that I decide I don't need, I don't think I'll have any difficulty selling it off. You know what I mean? I never have, really.
Right. So where do we stand with construction at
So
this point?
since the last time that you and I spoke on the podcast, with the bench, so all of the bench work for the most part, and I say for the most part, the D&H Peninsula, the spine of it is up, but the shape of it is not developed yet. That's something to come. The focus has really been on getting the Conrail mainline back contiguous and be able to run the layout again. That's really what I would like to do. I don't want to take another year, you know what I mean, and not have any op sessions. I want to get right back on the horse. So my focus is not to rush it and to enjoy the process, certainly, but also not to waste time in terms of getting back to that state. So at this point, I've got about 10 feet of sub roadbed to go. And I'm ready to lay track that will connect up the Lehigh line. And we have developed the whole DuPont area, which was a very interesting and very complex interchange from a model railroad building, and I guess to a lesser extent for the prototype to build, between the D&H and Conrail. It's one of the things that was a must-have in this layout. So even though I'm not focused on getting the full D&H mainline up and running, anything relating to that, I had to build. And it's a very three-dimensional thought process. So although I had the whole thing planned out pretty well in 2D, I don't know about you. I've always found that when you start working with the real thing and you're dealing with grades and interactions and things that need to cross and what have you, sometimes you can get some surprises out of that. So,
Doesn't always translate well to
no,
3D.
I mean, maybe if I was one of those CAD guys, you know what I mean, and I could do all of that, but that's, even though I'm in IT, that's not me. So
Yeah.
I need to stand in the space. There were whole sections of this layout that I deliberately didn't design in any detail because I didn't have a feel for how the space was going to evolve. And really, all of that has manifested itself during this calendar year, you know? So it's been a very interesting and engaging process. And what I've told a lot of people is one of my biggest problems in the last 3 months is staying out of the train room. In fact, today I spent all day yesterday and today at the install desk because the installs were just piling up again. And you know, unfortunately, I've got some very, very, very nice, very patient customers that understand that sometimes life intrudes into some of these things. But you know, I don't want to be that guy, you know, that the stuff just piles up for months and months and nothing ever happens. So it was weighing on me, so I jumped on the installs. And I've had a big bulge in the IT business as well over the last couple of months. Plus, I was trying to build a bathroom in my office here and to be totally done with all construction and mess. And that's at about 95% completed, you know. So I haven't exactly been bored all of this time. But I have to force myself to do some of this other stuff because the process of what's going on in the train room is so interesting and so engaging, and frankly, just so much fun that it's a really attractive nuisance, you know. And if I go down there to do some installs, well, I have to pass through the train room. And sometimes it takes me an hour to get there, and it's not that long a trip.
It's like trying to pass through a black hole, right?
Well, you know, you just kind of glance at something and you think, you know, a lot of what you do at this stage is you're standing there just looking at it and trying to picture things, you know. And you were talking about this earlier, how I have to get it in my mind before I build it. I don't know how anybody can build something if it's not in their mind, right? That's where it comes from.
Yep.
And until I have some good sense of it in my head, there's literally nothing that's going to happen on that particular thing. Now, sometimes you do some mock-ups and try some things, and you're trying to see how it can be. That's a little different, obviously, but much of it is, you know, you're trying to envision how it's all going to work together. And the section I'm working on right now is the most challenging piece of model railroading I've ever built. It's on two sides of a wall with two openings in that wall with two railroads on three different grades. Other than that, it's pretty simple.
No big deal.
Yeah, I mean, there's interaction on either side of the wall with what's going on in the other, and if I can pull it off, it's going to be something, I think, you know. And I think I will be able to pull it off, but it's as I told people, I said I'm in the teeth of the grade now, so a lot of the speed of construction that you've seen in the last couple of months, we're slowing right down because now this is the really challenging stuff, but it's also
Sure.
some of the most interesting.
I understand. Now, you provided some data in terms of linear feet of bench work, and that's a pretty eye-opening number. But do you have benchmarks as far as what you're looking to accomplish in the next month, 2 months, 6 months, that sort of thing?
I'm trying to keep that. Well, all right. So, as a project manager, obviously, I know that if you don't have a goal, you're not going to reach it. So, by the same token, I don't want to approach this like a Manhattan Project where I'm just anxious to get it done with. I want to make sure that I'm enjoying it along the whole journey because, let's face it, I'm probably not going to build another addition in my life. And I'm probably. Some of the things I'm doing, I may be not doing again. So I want to enjoy it. But like I had said earlier, I think the goal of getting the layout up and running again, getting the Lehigh line connected, is a worthy one. And I was shooting for June. Might be July. I mean, there's a lot of variables. You know, it might even be August, but I don't want it to go into the fall. I really think that if I've only got 10 more feet of sub road bed to build, and the track and wiring that goes into that, and maybe some testing, should be doable. Things that can impact that, of course, are, you know, something about this. You got family stuff going on. Got another grandchild on the way. You never know when your son's gonna parachute in from Florida and throw a giant monkey wrench into the works. A welcome one, but you know it has a time impact. I've got the New England meet coming up. I've got a railfan trip to my modeling area with my buddy Dave and Joe Posick and Mike Confalone from my ops crew, in part so that we can scout some really good photo backdrop locations and get some good photos, because June really is the time of year that I get the best photos for backdrops, and it's the one opportunity to do that. So there's that, you know what I mean? So by the time you factor in everything else that's going on, I've got some major IT work coming up. Can I make that deadline? I honestly don't know. I'm not going to lose sleep over it, but I'm also going to continue at every opportunity to have fun building the railroad, you know? And I think that when you spend time doing something, you accomplish a lot more than when you don't. How's that for a safe statement?
Yeah, there's no question, no question. And it'd be interesting to see what you come back with from this next railfan trip. I mean, these are always eye-opening experiences for you, as well as highly educational. And I know that this trip will cover some of the new areas that you're modeling.
Oh, absolutely. Not that I haven't been to these areas before, not that I haven't taken photos before, but now we've got the actual spaces where the actual photos need to go. And I think that we can take a look at it through that lens and really, I think, do a better job of getting the right photo, you know. And it's a funny coincidence too. I've been also doing a lot of magazine research. There's been some specific things that I've been looking for, and it's caused me to go back to, you know, old Rail Paces and some Rails Northeast. Remember that magazine? And
Oh,
you
sure.
know, just really delving into the archives, you know. So I open up one Rail Pace, and there's this cool photo of a train in Pittston Yard at night. It's a night shot. And I look at the caption, and it's taken by Joe Posick with lighting, night lighting by Mike Confalone.
Oh, jeez.
So I get on the phone to MC, as I call him, and I say, "You never told me you did this photography in Pittston Yard." And he remembered it, but he had kind of forgotten about it, you know, because it was a while back. I mean, this was back in the early 90s, I think, that they were
Jeez.
doing it. But I
Wow.
said, boy, I'll bet nobody at that time could have envisioned that the guy taking the photo in Pittston Yard would be my Pittston Yard master here someday, you know, and that the guy supplying the lighting for it would be operating on a layout based on that very scene. You know, it's just funny how life goes sometimes in that way.
It's funny. It's coincidental, I mean, just who would have thought? It's like,
Well, you know, the future is it will surprise you very often.
absolutely. You've mentioned, I mean, usually this is in my basket of things to talk about, but it's in yours tonight. You mentioned you had a Grafton update.
Well, actually, yeah, this was something my buddy Dave sent over to me, because he knows we're interested in the Grafton and Upton, and now that he's retired, you know, he finds all kinds of interesting things online with all of his extra time. So he sent me over this link to Progressive Railroading, which is a magazine I actually used to subscribe to. It's a industry trade publication, and you know, for railroads. And the headline is, and this is dated May 6th, so it's a very, very timely piece. And it's got a picture here, and the headline says, Chara Solutions opens rail-served fly ash terminal in Massachusetts. You probably know about this, right? You've probably seen this. It's the
Yep.
yeah, but I guess it's open at this point, and they're, they're announcing it. So I thought it was interesting that it would make national news like this.
Well, I think any new online industry, these days is news. The railroads, the large railroads are not really bringing in new industry.
Right. If anything, they're more focused on precision railroading.
Right. They're more focused on moving product from point A to point B.
They're more focused on pleasing the hedge funds that own their stock.
Right, and that too. But it's these short lines, that are really bringing, the smart ones, like the Grafton and Upton are enticing industry to the area. And they're, in this case, they're reviving communities. Well, I shouldn't even say reviving. I'm not sure that they were ever flourishing at any point. I mean, these are all very small towns. The only major industry that was anywhere near their right of way was Wyman Gordon, which is a huge manufacturer of precision parts in Grafton, Mass. And they played a very large role in the wars in producing armament, etc.
Right.
In fact, they were so productive that it might be just urban legend, but it was considered to be one of the ground zero points in a nuclear war.
Oh, nice. Believe it or not,
But
so was Chamberlain here in New Bedford. But I didn't know anything really about the fly ash business. I just figured it was something to be disposed of. But this company has 40 locations nationwide, and they provide Class C and Class F fly ash to ready-mix concrete producers. So that's where it's going. It's the aggregate in some of the concrete.
And along those same lines, another railroad that kind of falls into that category, although and that it's a short line, although their business, the business that they serve are substantially different, is the Seaview Railroad
Sure.
down in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. And I've been by there and through there a number of times, and in my
Where haven't you been?
I mean, and
I mean,
that's part
you
of
basically cover all of southeastern New England, right?
That's true. If you go down and count the number of freight cars that are on sidings within the Seaview complex, which is the old Quonset Point Naval Station.
Can you drive basically in there in anywhere you want, or are there some restrictions?
No, you can pretty much, I mean, you can't. General Dynamics has a big facility in there. In fact, they're growing considerably because they won the contract for the newest class of submarine that's about to be built.
So it's not
And
all in Groton then.
no, Electric Boat, the Electric Boat division of General Dynamics is also located at Quonset Point. But you can drive through the entire complex. It's not a military base anymore.
Yeah, it's public roads. It's like the Port of Albany or something like that.
There is a there the there is still a naval airstrip there. And in fact, you can sit there and watch the cargo planes take off all day, and nobody's going to bother you. But the amount of rail traffic through into that facility is just unbelievable. In fact, it was interesting. I had some time to kill a couple of weeks ago, so I was riding around there, and amongst the remnants from the Naval Air Station were a Vietnam War era F-4 fighter,
Oh wow, a Phantom?
which Which, you know, was the predominant fighter attack plane during the Vietnam War
Right.
and afterwards.
A lot of them got shot down there.
Yeah, and it was just really kind of the cockpit that was sitting there, and the rest had been cut up and was sitting beside it, which was kind of sad. But there was a complete, and I don't believe it's functional, but a complete A6,
Really?
which is a two-seater
That's the
attack.
Warthog, right?
No, that's an A10.
Oh, okay, an A6. A6, is that a
Yeah.
carrier-based plane?
It's a carrier-based plane. It was called the Intruder. In fact, there was a movie called Flight of the Intruder that came out probably in the early 90s, late 80s, that focused on that particular plane. But so it's still an interesting place. It's a commercial port now. And there's a lot of big industry down there,
I'll
but
have
the
to check it
number,
out someday if I ever leave the compound.
yeah, they use a couple of SW7s. They're probably sevens. I don't know. I know they're not 1500s, but I don't know enough about the SW series to
Seven's pretty old.
distinguish.
I'll bet they're 1200s or something like that.
They could be. That was the other thing I was going to say. They might be 1200s, but I don't know, exterior from an exterior perspective, what the difference is to tell. So,
Well, the seven head was unique in having that letterboard gap between the louvers. That was a unique spotting feature for the seven.
okay. Well, I'll have to look more closely the next time I see them.
Did you notice if they were flexi-coil trucks?
I don't believe they are.
Okay.
I think they're just regular
AAR.
AAR, thank you. Anybody in the area, who's unaware of it, you can get there pretty easy off of Route 95 and just south of Providence. And it's interesting. It's kind of a cool place to rail fan. They're running trains all day long throughout there, so. I think we're covered for tonight, Mike.
Yeah, I think that was a healthy effort for a couple of aging model railroaders.
Folks, thank you very much for listening. As always, thank you for your patience and sticking with us while I find the time to get this done. And we look forward to talking to you next month.
Well, nice to rediscover Mr. Mason.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.